This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Laura and Emma, a novel by Kate Greathead, read by Madeline Mabee. 1980. Laura sometimes woke up in the night, rattled by thoughts she'd never have during the day. A reoccurring nocturnal concern was that her apartment wasn't really hers. She owned it. Her name was on the door. There were official papers. But this wouldn't always be the case. Someday it would belong to someone else. Looking around her bedroom, envisioning everything packed up in boxes to be hauled off by movers, was very unsettling. But this was the inevitable outcome of apartments. No one's really belonged to them. In 100 years, the apartments of everyone she knew would be inhabited by future generations, whose taste in music and art and films and clothes would be completely foreign to her. Not that it mattered, as she and everyone she knew would be dead. It was ridiculous to worry about, but in the sobering still of the small hours, these thoughts consumed her, and were she to have a husband, Laura imagined she'd wake him up to unload them, and his laughing at their absurdity, and her laughing back, and then, feeling reassured and safely contained within the walls that surrounded her bed, drifting back to sleep. The other time Laura thought having a husband would be nice was when something broke, and it was too late to call the super. If it was after 9 o'clock and she discovered her bedroom window was swollen shut from the humidity, or the smoke detector started beeping in need of a new battery, she had to live with it until the morning. That was it, though. These occasions aside, Laura was getting along very well without a man in her life. But still, it upset her, the idea that she didn't truly belong in her own apartment.
"Really? It doesn't matter who you marry," Laura's mother had said more than once. "However madly in love you are in the beginning, one day you will find yourself sitting across a table from him thinking, anything, anything, anything would be better than this." Laura had never been madly in love, or even sanely in love. She didn't hate sex, but she didn't particularly like it either. The idea of being expected to do it all the time seemed exhausting. She was not a romantically or sexually inclined person. She'd heard that this was the case for some people, and suspected she fell into this category. But, upon turning 30, she decided to seek a professional opinion, and made an appointment to meet with a psychoanalyst. The office was on the ground floor of a Turtle Bay brownstone, and the analyst was comfortingly older, with a kind, intelligent face. Laura could tell he'd been handsome in his youth, but in a non-threatening way. After inviting her into his office, he took a seat behind a desk and gestured for her to take the chair across from him.
"Before we get started, I'd like to answer any questions you might have about how this works, and hear a bit about you and what brings you here."
"I know how it works," Laura told him. "I'm afraid I'm not here as a long-term patient." Laura paused, in case he was interested only in long-term patients. When he didn't say anything, she proceeded to explain her reason for coming. Marriage had never appealed to Laura the way it did to other women. She was flattered by and appreciated the attention of men, but could do with just that. She was more than content with her life choices and current situation.
"Then what brings you here?"
"I'm not sure," Laura admitted. "I recently saw my internist for my annual appointment, and the results came back and everything looked fine, and I guess I came here hoping you could perform the psychoanalytical equivalent?"
"A routine mental," the analyst said, chuckling. "You want a clean bill of mental health."
Laura smiled sheepishly.
"Well, from what you've told me, it sounds like there are no issues."
"It was probably silly of me to come," she said. The analyst's face suddenly turned serious. He stood up and pointed to the couch at the other end of the room.
"If you would lie down, we can get started."
Laura felt funny lying down in front of a stranger and asked if she could sit on the couch instead.
Your choice. However, many people find it easier to open up lying down.
In the spirit of cooperation, she reclined. Notebook and pen in hand, the analyst settled into an armchair beside her.
Should I start with my childhood? She asked after a minute of silence.
If you like,
he said.
Rather than sketch out her parents or brother or the general emotional atmosphere of her upbringing, she began describing a morning routine from her early childhood. It was of sitting on the toilet, trying to go big jobby, as her nurse called it. Marge insisted that this happen every day at the conclusion of breakfast, and Laura's day was suspended until she did it. Marge would come into the bathroom afterward to inspect the evidence. Laura's digestive system wouldn't always cooperate with the schedule, and there were many lonely mornings of sitting on the toilet for hours, pushing and pushing and pushing until she was gasping for air and having nothing to show for her efforts. As Laura lay there reliving this, the contours of the light fixture on the ceiling went slack, and she realized she was crying. She was glad she was lying down, as it meant her analyst couldn't see her face. But then, a box of Kleenex appeared and hovered above her chest. He was leaning across the space between them to offer it. Her deep breathing must have given her away.
"This is embarrassing," she said, taking a tissue and dotting the corners of her eyes.
"Not at all," he said kindly.
Laura excused herself to the bathroom. She blew her nose and splashed cold water on her face. When she felt composed, she returned to the couch where she resumed their session upright. Among the misperceptions others had about Laura was that she was oblivious to her looks. This was largely due to the simplicity of her wardrobe. To work, she wore a white turtleneck, one of five rotating Laura Ashley skirts, and a pair of Fry cowboy boots. One year earlier, a photographer named Bill Cunningham had taken a picture of her in this outfit. Laura had been waiting at the crosswalk of Lexington and 61st and hadn't known her photograph was being taken until it appeared in a series of street portraits in the New York Times. Her mother had been the first to spot it and called Laura to tell her. Laughing too hard to speak, she'd put Laura's father on the phone, who directed her to the page of the newspaper. Laura had put the clipping under a magnet on the fridge, but then this struck her as egotistical, so she took it down, and with the intention of keeping it safe, she'd put it somewhere she couldn't remember. Others in her social circle had also laughed at the photo. Of everyone they knew, Laura was the last person one would expect to see in the New York Times as a paragon of Manhattan style. It was true Laura had little interest in clothes. But what people assumed was her absent-minded ignorance of fashion was actually concern for the fate of the earth. Everything she owned would one day end up in a landfill, and she avoided acquiring anything she didn't need. She'd once heard the phrase, use it up, wear it out, make it do, or do without, and guiltily thought of it every time she bought new clothes, which was itself an ordeal, as it was difficult to find clothes that fit her. Laura was so small that most things had to be tailored, and to avoid the hassle, she often found herself browsing the children's section of whatever store she was in. One afternoon, she was in the boys' department of Morris Brothers Department Store on 85th and Broadway, looking for a new winter parka. They were having a sale, when she felt something warm and moist against her thigh. She looked down and discovered a little boy, maybe 3 or 4, burrowing his face into her jeans, seemingly for the purpose of wiping his nose.
"Excuse me," Laura told him, realizing he must have mistaken her for his mother. "But we're not related."
The little boy looked up at her. His face darkened, and he began breathing in a husky, emotional way. With each exhalation, a green bubble of mucus protruded from his nose.
"You're not my mom," he told her, shaking his head.
There was a petulant, accusatory edge to his tone, as though Laura had posed as his mother with the intention of kidnapping him.
"It's okay," Laura attempted to reassure the child. "Your mom is somewhere in this store. I'll help you find her."
She reached out to pat the top of his head,
but this only made the boy more suspicious, and after batting her hand away, he took a doddering step backward, lost his balance, and fell on his bottom. For a moment he sat there in silence, a confused, slightly panicked look on his face, like he was playing the part of a little boy in a movie and had forgotten his line. Then he opened his mouth and screamed.
"Joshua!"
an equally loud voice shrieked from the other end of the store. A woman came galloping toward them. "See? I told you she was here," Laura said cheerfully, and stepped aside as the mother swooped in like a bird of prey, scooped the child up with feral urgency, and began pecking his face with kisses. As a dramatic reunion unfolded, Laura was troubled by two thoughts, the first being that this little boy had mistaken her for this other woman, who had a homely, disheveled look you often saw on the Upper West Side. Laura knew she was not a smart dresser, but she didn't like to think she was in the same category as this woman. The second wasn't so much a thought as a sudden awareness of her irrelevance in their universe, the parameters of which seemed to have contracted so that it contained only the woman and the boy, that this hurt Laura's feelings, confused and embarrassed her. With the exception of Margaret, nearly all her contemporaries had children by now. Though a few had privately admitted to feeling initially bewildered by the little creature they'd brought home from the hospital, Edith going so far as to compare its appearance to a space alien, it was only a matter of time before they fell under the spell of unconditional maternal love. Though this seemed to be the universal trend, it still struck Laura as a roll of the dice, to allow fate to assign you a person whom you were expected to adore for the rest of your life. You did not get to choose your child, and while all the mothers she knew gave the impression of having received exactly what they would have ordered, it still seemed like a cavalier thing to do. Also, selfish. It had taken the world's population until 1804 to reach 1 billion, and another 123 years to double. What Laura imagined people assumed would be her greatest regret, not having any children, she considered her greatest gift to the planet.
"How do you feel about money?" her analyst asked during their second session.
Laura thought it was an odd question. She wasn't sure what there was to say. Her income wasn't much, but she had a modest trust, which generated annual dividends that her father's accountant would transfer into her bank account. This extra money allowed her to contribute to various nonprofits, such as the Natural Resources Defense Council, the New York City Commission for the Homeless, National Public Radio, and the Barnard Scholarship Fund. What remained of this money she hadn't earned went toward Christmas tips for her super, seamstress, the man who resold her boots, the cashiers at her grocery store, the owner of the hot dog cart where she bought her afternoon Coca-Cola, her mailwoman, and the nice family who ran the laundromat across the street. She didn't share any of this with her analyst because it didn't feel worth his time.
"Many people are uncomfortable discussing money," he said after a silence.
"I'm not uncomfortable discussing it," Laura clarified. "It just doesn't interest me. It doesn't feel relevant to what I'm doing here."
"And what would you say you are doing here?"
"I thought analysis was mostly for figuring out the emotional impact of your childhood."
"And do you think," the analyst asked, "that growing up in such a wealthy family had any kind of impact?"
The word wealthy embarrassed Laura. It was not a word she or anyone she was close to used, and she wished her analyst hadn't spoken it. "There are a lot of things that are difficult for me to talk about," she said. "Things I've never discussed with anyone. Money isn't one of them."
"What about sex?" he asked.
The whole point of having the patient lie down, as Laura understood it, was to avoid seeing the analyst and thus reduce inhibition. But today, the analyst's armchair was positioned at an angle where one of his shoes and a part of his leg poked into her frame of vision. He must have been sitting with his legs crossed, because the foot was suspended in the air, and it bopped with a restless energy that was incongruent with his calm and measured speaking voice. As with many men, his pants rode up his calf when his legs were crossed, and his black socks only went up so far, exposing an inch of pale, hairy shin bone. "What about it?" Laura asked him back.
"Well,
The foot bopping picked up with the speed of a dog's wagging tail.
Do you ever masturbate?
I'm glad you ended it, said Margaret, Laura's oldest friend and confidant. The whole thing is a racket. Think of all the people we know who are going. Do any of them seem to be getting better? Laura pondered this. New Yorkers are so susceptible to these things, Margaret continued. The other day, I overheard a woman in Bloomingdale's talking about primal scream therapy. Margaret paused for Laura's reaction. That's the kind where you pay $100 for the privilege of sitting in a so-called doctor's office and screaming at the top of your lungs. I've heard of it.
Apparently,
it's supposed to take a year of weekly appointments to do the trick. But this woman claimed it cured her in a single session. Or saved her life, as she put it. Margaret laughed. Have you ever heard anything so ridiculous?
The poor neighbors, Laura said. Margaret had once confessed to feeling similarly indifferent to intercourse, but this didn't stop her from marrying Tripp, a boy they'd grown up with who had a reputation for a voracious and often indiscriminate sexual appetite, among other vices. As a teenager, Tripp had once gotten so tipsy at a cotillion ball that he'd vomited and a string bean had come out of his nostril. Though this had happened over half a lifetime ago, Laura still had trouble looking at him without this image coming to mind. Evidently, this was not the case for Margaret, who, upon their being declared husband and wife, thrust a triumphant fist into the air like an Olympian mounting the pedestal after receiving the gold. Following the ceremony, there was a reception at the Carlisle. A fleet of London town cars had been rented to chauffeur the guests, but Laura decided to walk. It had rained earlier, and the late April air was ripe with freshly fallen petals and the loamy odor of wet concrete. Puddles reflected quivering images of the blossoming pear trees that lined Madison Avenue. The sun on the sidewalk radiated warmth. It felt like the city was waking up from a nap. Laura could have walked all afternoon, but eventually she arrived at the Carlisle and felt obligated to go in. The reception was a tedious marathon of 30-second conversations with people she knew but didn't really know. None of the toasts mentioned the string bean incident, especially not hers, which, Laura realized halfway into it, focused exclusively on the earlier years of her friendship with Margaret, and offered nothing in the way of the woman Margaret had become, nor of Margaret and Tripp, which was what wedding toasts were supposed to do, especially when you were the maid of honor. When it was time for the bride to toss the bouquet, instead of haphazardly chucking it into the throng of little girls who stood on the dance floor waving their arms above their heads, Margaret, who happened to be very coordinated, threw it in such a way that it soared up and diagonally across the dance floor and landed at Laura's feet. All eyes on her, she had no choice but to pick it up. The girls flocked over, and she handed it to the youngest of them, who squealed over her prize. The library, once the primary residence of Laura's great-grandfather, was now a museum that was also used for private events. Originally, this was a privilege extended just to corporate members and institutional donors, but the library's endowment was limited, and a decade ago, the board decided to make the venue available for rent to the public. Its tastefully renovated period rooms and marble banquet hall made it a popular wedding spot, so a new position was created, wedding coordinator. Laura, having just graduated from college with a degree in English, was initially reluctant to take the job. She wasn't particularly ambitious, but she wanted to get involved in larger issues, do something that made a positive impact. But then she'd found the apartment. Though her parents would be helping her with the monthly maintenance regardless of her employment status, it didn't feel right to own an apartment if you didn't have a job. She accepted the position, and she remained there a decade later. She knew it wasn't like this for everyone. Those plucky, brave souls who moved to New York City on their own and had to start a life from scratch. Laura recalled telling her parents she'd been taken off the wait list for Barnard. "That's terrific," her father had said, while her mother had groaned. I suppose this means we'll have to have What's-His-Face and his dreadful wife over for dinner.
Laura was envious of others' accounts of struggle, which were recalled with a certain fondness. It had been an adventure, the thrill of the hustle. They'd chased a dream against the odds, and now they were living it. She could only imagine the pride of being personally responsible for everything one had, professional success, friends, apartment, and being able to trace all this back to hard work. Knowing that everything in their lives wasn't a given, that it could have all gone a very different way. Laura had never even read the classifieds. There'd been no reason. Everything came to her through direct channels, and if her immediate network didn't provide it, someone knew someone who could help. When deadlines were missed or obstacles encountered, a person of power or influence intervened on her behalf. Often this person didn't know Laura. It was a friend of the family, a former classmate's neighbor, the stepfather of a cousin-in-law. It didn't matter. Phone calls were made, exceptions were granted. She was put on the top of the list. Many of the brides Laura worked with were unaware of her personal affiliation with the library, and she preferred it that way. Nepotism aside, Laura was ashamed of her great-grandfather, whose legacy of shrewd business dealings earned him a full page in her 10th-grade American history book in the section Robber Barons. Her mother bemoaned the fact that she hadn't inherited a dime of his money. Everything had gone to her uncle, his firstborn son. But Laura was glad this was the case. She did not want to be the beneficiary of the man who'd founded a bank in his name and had once been photographed with a dwarf on his lap. And yet, she was aware of experiencing a flush of something resembling pride upon hearing his name invoked by people who had no idea she was his great-granddaughter. The pride of moral superiority, suspecting that were they to share her ancestry, which also included the mayor of the original Mayflower community and the founder of the country's first insurance company, they would seize every opportunity to let it be known. Laura didn't like vacations or travel, though come August, she often relocated to 136, the four-story brownstone on East 65th Street where she'd grown up. Her parents spent the month in Europe, so she had the place to herself. There was a garden out back where she could lie in her bikini, something she'd never felt comfortable doing in Central Park. Laura loved sunbathing. She knew about the studies saying it was dangerous, but she kept doing it anyway. She wasn't a drinker, a smoker, an overeater, or a consumer, but she was a sunbather. This was her one vice, and she'd made peace with it. One Sunday night, after a weekend of reading and sunbathing at 136, Laura lay in bed on the verge of sleep when she heard the carpeted creak of someone coming up the stairs. There had been a string of burglaries on the block that summer, and she'd half been expecting this. She lay still as a corpse, which is what she'd heard you were supposed to do in these situations. So long as the intruder didn't think you'd seen him, he had no reason to kill you. To mitigate the terror, she made a mental inventory of all the people she'd known who'd lived through these situations to tell the story at a dinner party. Then, she started imagining how she would narrate her own story of surviving a break-in. Typically, Laura became nervous when telling an anecdote to a group, and often held back for this reason. But this would be too good not to relay. She was at the part of the story that coincided with the present, and was waiting for what happened next, when she heard the toilet flush, followed by the sound of an electric toothbrush, and she realized that it was just another one of Nicholas's friends. Her brother, Nicholas, occasionally let out-of-town friends stay there. Laura didn't mind. She felt safer knowing another person was sleeping in the house, but it would have been nice for Nicholas to have called to let her know of his guest in advance. They crossed paths in the kitchen the next morning.
Jefferson, he said, offering his hand.
Laura, she said, shaking it. She made herself a cup of tea and sat down to read the Times. There was apparently a new kind of cancer that, for reasons that remained a mystery to the medical community, afflicted only New Yorkers and people who lived in San Francisco. The article made her anxious, and she was relieved when she got to the end and it said that no cases had been reported outside the homosexual community or in women. She was annoyed the journalist hadn't thought to put this fact in the beginning. After making some eggs, Jefferson joined her at the table and took a section of the paper. At one point, he spoke.
Evolution is happening, and I'm excited about where it's taking us.
Laura didn't know what to say to this, so she made a concentrating expression and pretended not to hear. Jefferson didn't initially strike Laura as handsome, but she saw how women might find him attractive. He had charisma and swagger and joie de vivre. Though he was not especially large in stature, there was something substantial about his build. He had a certain density that gave the impression of bearing more weight than the space he took up. He moved through the rooms with proprietary ease and had no qualms helping himself to anything he wanted. That his comfort in the house she'd grown up in surpassed her own might have irked her had she not found him so amusing. When asked how he knew her brother, they'd been roommates at St. George's, Jefferson seemed momentarily taken aback, perhaps mildly hurt to realize that Nicholas had never mentioned him. Hoping to spare his feelings, Laura explained that Nicholas rarely volunteered anything about that chapter of his life. Over the course of the week they spent cohabitating, Jefferson regaled Laura with descriptions of pranks the two boys had undertaken at St. George's, short-sheeting their dorm mother's bed, covering the headmaster's car with shaving cream, releasing a box of crickets in the chapel during morning prayers.
"We had the best time," Jefferson punctuated each account.
Laura was surprised and relieved to hear this. 5 years older, Laura had been a mother figure to Nicholas when he was little, reading books to him, teaching him how to spell his name, tie his shoes, how to identify the different kinds of birds that passed through their back garden. As a child, Nicholas suffered from a terrible case of eczema and a mild but pesky stutter, which had made things difficult for him at school. To make up for it, Laura would always intentionally lose at pickup sticks and jacks and checkers, which they played a lot. For the first decade of his life, Laura had tended to Nicholas's needs, and he had basked in her attention and gestures of affection without any embarrassment. If he'd had a bad dream, it was Laura's bed he came to in the middle of the night. When it was time for Laura to apply to college, the prospect of abandoning Nicholas at 136 made her feel so guilty that she decided to forego her dream of a quaint New England campus and chose a school in New York City. This had been for naught, however, as Nicholas ended up being sent off to boarding school. It would toughen him up, had been their parents' reasoning. The sensitive boy who had turned to Laura for everything came back from his first year at St. George's a remote and surly adolescent. He did not want to visit the Natural History Museum, go to the movies, get a hamburger at Jackson Hole, or do any of the things the two of them used to do together. Laura's attempts to rekindle their closeness continued to be rebuffed in the ensuing years. Even their mother had noticed the change, grimly speculating to Laura and her father that something must have happened to Nicholas at school. "You think he's being teased or bullied?" Laura had asked.
"Everyone gets a bit of that at boarding school," her father responded.
"I mean something worse than that," Laura's mother said, "a sexual violation of some sort." Jefferson's jolly narrative of her brother's life at boarding school put such sinister fears to rest. It was a comfort to know that Nicholas had been one of the boys, making mischief, having a good time. The evening shadows of the trees outside danced across the walls with the languid quiver of plants in a fish tank. Laura lay supine on the ancient sofa by the window. With each breath, she sank deeper into the silky give of its bosomy cushions, once rose-colored, now faded to a pearly pink. She was reading an advance copy of a book that a friend who worked in publishing had sent, thinking it would be up her alley. It was actually the kind of book Laura avoided, pure fodder for insomnia, but now that she'd begun it, she felt obligated to finish. Between turning pages, her free hand absently stroked the distinctly distressed spot by her side, where Mr. Baggins, a beloved childhood corgi, had once nestled. When Jefferson came into the room, she sat up, scooched to the far end of the sofa, and drew her knees to her chest. Now her free hand rested on the arm, plucking and strumming the strings of its threadbare surface,
releasing a homey musk of aging upholstery, her father's pipe tobacco, and subtle undertones of other dearly loved, long-deceased pets. After a few minutes of silence, Jefferson made a psst sound, as one would do trying to get someone's attention in a library. He lay on the chaise perpendicular to Laura, ankles crossed, hands clasped behind his head.
"Have I told you lately that you're beautiful?"
"Thank you," Laura responded, attempting to hold the book in a way that obstructed her face from his gaze. She could feel the corners of her mouth twitching. It was such a silly thing to say to someone you'd known for a week.
"I wouldn't have thought something called The Fate of the Earth was a funny book," Jefferson said.
Laura ignored his comment and drew the book even closer to her face. This worked. Jefferson stopped talking. But she had trouble regaining focus, too aware of his presence in the room, and then of his absence. After listening to his footsteps bounce down the stairs, Laura tried to imagine what he was doing in the basement. Eventually, he trotted back up with a bottle of red wine from her father's collection. She agreed to share it with him. She wondered why she didn't drink more often. She was less shy, and it was a wonderful feeling.
"You have a nice figure," Jefferson said, pouring her a second glass.
Laura was often told this, and normally her response was to complain about her height, 5'2", and say she wished she were taller, but tonight, she said, "I know," and fingered the stem of her glass.
"You don't act like it," he said.
Laura shrugged and leaned over to pluck a sprig of dried lavender out of the arrangement on the table. After discovering it had no scent, she twirled it in her fingers for a bit, then tucked it behind her ear and pretended to go back to her book, knowing that Jefferson knew she was pretending and would remain there staring at her for as long as it took for her to give up the act. It wasn't lust, but rather vanity that made her agree to take her clothes off, and from there on it was a feeling of obligation that made her carry through with the rest of it. What transpired was not unlike all the other times, and it did not undo Laura's conviction that something was different about her, that her experience of sex wasn't what it was for others. But as she lay there afterward, his arms tethered around her as though she were a precious thing he'd just caught and now might run away.
"Soft little fucker,"
he'd murmured, stroking her shoulder. That part she liked very much. She hadn't been prepared for this, and the next morning, Laura went back to her apartment to retrieve her diaphragm. Then she made an appointment to get her legs waxed, and then she found herself circulating the aisles of Bloomingdale's trying on different scents. Laura had slipped out before Jefferson had woken up that morning and hadn't left a note. She liked the idea of his waiting and wondering when she'd come back. By the time she set out to return to 136, it was already evening. The sky was a benign shade of lavender, but soon it would erupt into a violent riot of pinks and reds. August in New York often gave Laura a sad, left-out feeling, but this evening she felt different. It was a time of day, during a time of year, when no one was in a rush. The sidewalks belonged to a procession of couples gratuitously strolling. Men took off their jackets and held them with two fingers behind their backs, the other arm draped around the waists of their companions. At one point, Laura got caught behind a couple with a young child who walked between them, one hand in the mother's, the other in the father's. The trio took up the width of the sidewalk, and every few steps the parents would chant, "One, two, three, wee!" and swing the child up off the ground. The child loved this, and would laugh with excitement each time, and upon being set back down, would immediately demand to be swung again. "More, more," it would plead. Jefferson did not come running to the door after Laura let herself in. She called his name, but he didn't answer. She went upstairs, and he wasn't in any of the bedrooms. The kitchen and living room were also empty, as was the dining room. He wasn't in the garden or basement either. She called Nicholas.
"Who's Jefferson?"
he asked. When she reminded him Jefferson had been his roommate at St. George's, Nicholas said,
"I lived in a single."
The whole thing left Laura perplexed and ashamed. Not only did she have no idea who he really was, but who was she to have been so easily seduced? Soft little fucker. It made her shudder. She vacated 136 after the episode and spent the remaining days of summer in her own apartment. Laura and Nicholas sat on a bench outside the restaurant waiting for their parents, who had returned from Europe that morning. A reservation had been made for 7. At 7:20, Laura speculated that perhaps they'd lain down for a nap and hadn't woken up.
"So, you think they're dead?" Nicholas said dryly.
"Of course not," Laura said, though she knew he was kidding. "I mean, maybe they were so exhausted from the trip that they slept through their alarm." Finally, a cab pulled up.
"Yoo-hoo!"
trilled their mother's voice through the back window. Their father emerged from the other side of the vehicle and walked around to open the door for her. Bibbs wore a lime green shift dress, and her hair pulled back in a headband in a way that looked French. She accepted Douglas's hand when climbing out of the cab, but once on both feet she batted it away, making a dramatic show of struggling to maintain her balance as she headed toward the curb.
"Don't worry, I'm not tipsy," she said giddily.
"I'm feeling the swells from the boat. Everything's still rocking." Upon reaching her children, Bibbs clutched Laura by the shoulders like a rag doll, kissed her firmly on each cheek, then turned and did the same with Nicholas.
"Good to see you kids," Douglas said,
giving Laura a single kiss on the cheek and patting Nicholas on the back as he ushered them into Claude's. A mirror hung on the wall behind their table. Catching a glimpse of herself, Bibbs straightened her shoulders and elongated her neck.
"Thank goodness for dim lighting," she said to no one in particular.
A busboy materialized and filled their water glasses. Bibbs dipped the corner of her napkin into hers and used it to wipe her husband's brows.
"This is a new routine we have," Douglas said, when Laura asked what she was doing. "Apparently there's a problem with my eyebrows."
"They're going rogue," Bibbs said gravely. "It happens to men in old age."
"I don't know what she's talking about." Laura smiled at her father.
"I'm talking about how a bird could lay an egg in them," said Bibbs.
Nicholas lowered his menu to have a look.
"I discovered my first few gray hairs," Laura volunteered, wanting to take the heat off Douglas.
"Oh, don't worry about that," Bibbs said. "Jean-Paul will take care of it. Let me make you an appointment with Jean-Paul. I'll be seeing him first thing in the morning."
"I'm not coloring my hair," Laura said. "It's only a few. But if they start to proliferate, I'm going to let it happen."
"But you're too young for that, darling. Much, much too young."
Bibbs looked at Douglas for support.
"Don't you agree, dear? Don't you think she's too beautiful to let that happen?"
Douglas, who looked embarrassed by the question, ignored it.
"Nicholas just told me he's getting a promotion."
"That's exciting," Laura said. "What does your new position entail?" Nicholas addressed his father while delivering a long-winded tangential explanation. Douglas sat listening with his hands clasped, periodically lowering his eyelids and nodding rapidly to indicate he understood. No need for Nicholas to elaborate in such detail. It was a counterproductive gesture, as each time he did this, Nicholas, who was very sensitive to their father's opinion, experienced a momentary relapse of his childhood stutter, and it took him that much longer to wrap up his point and move on to the next. Laura knew her father wasn't a cruel man, but she couldn't understand how he could be so clueless. Nicholas had not inherited their father's unflappable confidence and placid demeanor, but he strived to project such an image, and it was painful to see him unravel before the person he most wanted to impress. Their food arrived, and as Nicholas paused to catch his breath and take a bite of pork chop, Douglas said,
"And when do you start?"
Nicholas's gaze fell to the table, and his fork went slack as he considered the question.
"I don't know the timeline, because nothing is set in stone yet."
Picking up his knife, he began cutting a baby potato in two.
I'm one of several in-house candidates they're considering. I mentioned that.
No, Douglas said, catching the attention of a passing waiter and pointing to his empty scotch glass. No, you did not mention that.
Bibbs was looking in the mirror again, but this time she was fixated on Laura's reflection. The intensity of her stare was unnerving, and Laura cocked her chin so that a curtain of hair obstructed her face. Bibbs reached out and tucked the hair behind Laura's ear. She leaned over and whispered,
"Gray hair isn't always a bad thing. Occasionally it can be quite beautiful. But instead of committing to it out of principle, I think you should have a wait-and-see approach, because you never know what shade of gray you're going to get. It could be a beautiful silvery shimmer, or it could be that moldy, off-white, yellowing, lampshade dog peed in the snow."
She lowered her eyes and gestured with her chin at a woman at another table.
"I'll keep an open mind," Laura whispered back.
The waiter brought the bill. Douglas placed his American Express card inside the check holder without reviewing the charges.
"Oh, I almost forgot," Bibbs said with excitement. "Someone broke into the house while we were gone. We've been burglarized."
Bibbs held out her fingers and frowned in concentration as she recalled the list of missing items.
"A box of silver cutlery, 2 fur coats, a pewter tea set, some first edition books, and a few other things I can't remember. The most bizarre items, don't you think? What would a crook want with a tea set?"
"To sell it for cash," Nicholas said. "You should file a police report."
"The Henrys are taking care of it," Douglas spoke up.
"Shh," Bibbs gave him a stern look. "I'm not done. You'll ruin the story." "He went to the Henrys next," Bibbs proceeded. "They went out of town, and their cleaning woman, that crazy Albanian, she came in and found him just sitting in the kitchen, eating breakfast, wearing Mr. Henry's robe. He'd spent the night in their bedroom, claimed to be a nephew. The Albanian didn't buy it. Smart cookie, picked up a frying pan and chased him out of the house and down the street."
"And was he apprehended?" Nicholas asked.
"He got away," Bibbs grinned. "Lucky man. She might have killed him."
"And how are you certain it was the same person?" Nicholas asked.
"They found 2 suitcases in the closet of the Henry's master bedroom, full of our things."
The waiter returned with the bill. Laura twirled a loose cuticle on her thumb until it came off in her fingers. Now that the full scope of her foolishness sank in, she felt oddly numb. So long as nobody knew about it, it could be as if it had never happened.
"So you got everything back?" she asked.
"It was all in the suitcases," Douglas confirmed as he signed the receipt.
"Everything was recovered," Bibbs reiterated, "except, of course, for Mr. Henry's slippers and robe."
It was no coincidence that all of Laura's doctors were male. She'd had a few encounters with female doctors over the years, and in each instance they'd attempted to engage her on a personal level, asking questions that went beyond her medical history. They weren't prying, merely trying to establish a friendly rapport. But that wasn't what she went to the doctor for. Male doctors, in Laura's experience, had no trouble with boundaries, and so she was flustered and irritated when Dr. Newman's response to her current symptoms, dizziness, loss of appetite, fatigue, included questions about her love life.
No, she was not seeing anyone.
Yes, of course that meant she was currently celibate.
How long had it been since her last relationship?
Laura recalled her brief courtship with Alan, a British journalist she'd met at Edith's wedding. About 3 or 4 years, she told him. She knew what he was thinking, and she resented his pity. She wished she could think of something clever or sassy to say, like Mary Tyler Moore would in this situation. Dr. Newman suggested she eat more red meat. It sounded like low iron. But just to rule out anything else, he would like to take a blood test. She was at work when Dr. Newman's office called. Laura's iron levels were low, but that wasn't the reason for her symptoms. Margaret subscribed to a certain set of rules and lacked the imagination to consider another perspective. Hers was a black-and-white view of the world, and when filtered through this narrow lens, there was no problem that didn't present an immediate, logical course of action, which was what Laura wanted right now, not to make a decision but to be told what to do. But Margaret, who typically reveled in presiding over the private lives of others, who gladly dispensed unsolicited critiques when Laura violated some unspoken social protocol, like wearing espadrilles to Janet's wedding, bringing her own cloth napkin to restaurants that provided only paper, or pointing out an adorable baby rat poking its head out of a flower bed on the curb of Madison Avenue, recused herself from weighing in on the matter, telling Laura it was too personal an issue. A decision a woman could only make for herself. Even more unhelpful, she was uncharacteristically philosophical about the ethical dimension of it, saying things like, "No one knows exactly when life begins." Laura wasn't looking for comfort, but she was struck by Margaret's tone, which felt coldly detached and ever so slightly judgmental that Laura would find herself in such a predicament. And then, the brusque way she'd ended their call. "We'll have to continue this. My husband just got home." My husband? It was a little early for Tripp to arrive home from the office, Laura thought as she put the phone down. 5 minutes later, the phone rang and it was Margaret. She might have sounded a little curt, she told Laura, and she was sorry if that was the case. "Is everything okay?" Laura asked, because Margaret rarely apologized, and her voice sounded a little muffled, like she'd been crying. After a moment of silence, Margaret burst into tears. "It's not so easy to get pregnant. Some happily married couples spend months and months trying to conceive, only to be told it's not in their cards." Margaret blew her nose. "So, for it to happen so easily for you, from a one-night stand with some con man, and you don't even want it." "I'm so sorry, Mags," Laura said. "I had no idea." The morning of her procedure, Laura woke up to discover a bird in her bedroom. A sparrow. The heat had been set too high the night before, and she'd slept with the window half open. Now she opened it all the way, but the bird was too agitated to find its way back out. Laura waited 20 minutes before calling the super, who didn't like to be bothered before 8. His wife answered the phone. She always seemed put out. Today she told Laura that Tony was in New Jersey, and when Laura asked when he'd be back, she said, "If he knows what's best for him, not any time soon." A little unprofessional, Laura thought, but she was afraid of Italians. "Okay," she said, "thank you," and hung up the phone. The bird continued to fly around her room in a skittish tizzy. She would need to catch it herself and let it out. Each time it landed on a surface to rest, Laura would gingerly approach, but the bird was terrified of her and would resume flight. The routine continued. Soon it was 8:30. Then it was 8:45. She thought about calling her OBGYN's office to ask them to tell the hospital she might be a little late, but what a ridiculous reason to be late for something like this. At 9:10, Laura lost her temper. "Fuck you," she cursed at the bird. "I'm just trying to save your life, and you're going to make me late to my abortion." Speaking these words restored Laura's calm. She was doing her best. She could only keep trying. Another 10 or 40 minutes passed. Laura lost track. It no longer mattered. She'd resigned herself to the situation. She wasn't going anywhere until she caught that bird. When it finally happened, there was a rush. Time stopped, then rapidly accelerated, before resuming to normal. Mission accomplished. Laura shut the window and looked at the clock. She would be late to her appointment, but if she got a move on, only 10 or 15 minutes. The feeling of the bird lingered as she took a taxi across town. For all the trouble it had given her, she was left only with the skin-touch memory of its weightless warmth, the swollen curve of its downy breast, the delicate tremble of its beleaguered heartbeat as she'd carried it to the window. As she'd leaned out her window over Lexington, There was a moment after she'd unclasped her fingers before the sparrow had taken off. For now, Margaret was the only person besides her doctors who knew. Margaret was a good friend. She called Laura at least twice a day just to check in, make sure that she wasn't overexerting herself, and had remembered to take her vitamins. Sometimes she would demand to know everything Laura had eaten that day. Occasionally, she lit into her for accidentally ingesting something on the list of dangerous foods, such as brie or prosciutto. When Laura quoted Edith as saying she'd lived on brie while pregnant with Jack, Margaret quoted Janet as saying she'd always wondered if Maxwell's slightly malformed earlobe was the result of the occasional cocktail she'd allowed herself. "When you're educated about these things," Margaret said, "and have the means to eat only what's healthy and safe, I find it hard to fathom why you would take any chances. In fact, I find it completely selfish and unconscionable to do otherwise." Laura took Margaret's criticism in stride, knowing it was related to her anxiety of not being able to monitor the daily routine of the woman whose child she would be adopting. 17, Caucasian, Staten Island, Margaret said. That's all the agency will tell me. Laura was reading The Times when she came across an article with the headline, "Mothers Who Don't Marry." Even in the era of the supermother, went the first paragraph, they stand out from the pack, ostensibly independent women who elect to become mothers out of wedlock, maintaining their careers while raising children in households without fathers or any talk of marriage. The article interviewed over a dozen of these supermothers. Several of them had had AID, artificial insemination by donor. AID for short, Laura added, as her parents and Nicholas absorbed the news. "I've always wanted to be a mother," she continued after a puzzled silence, "and as I'm not getting any younger, I decided to make arrangements to do this on my own." Her parents nodded. Nicholas stared into his glass. Their waiter approached, then, intuiting a sensitive conversation, politely retreated. "To hell with husbands," Bibbs declared. "I think it's wonderful. Hip hip hooray." Douglas raised his glass. Nicholas blinked rapidly as he mimicked his father's gesture, on both their parts an earnest attempt to convey something along the lines of congratulatory approval. "And who is the donor?" Bibbs asked. "It's completely anonymous," Laura told her. "He's 25, in good health. That's all they'll tell me."
"But he's of European descent?" Nicholas asked.
"Yes," Laura said, and then, because it was the first country that came to mind, "Swedish ancestry."
"So the baby will be Swedish," Bibbs said with a smile.
As a child, Bibbs had had a Swedish nursemaid, Sophia, to whose influence Laura attributed her mother's lifelong infatuation with the Swedes, the most beautiful people in the world. "Half," Laura said. "And she doesn't wear a lick of makeup," Laura had overheard someone say of her once. The comment pleased her because it was true. Most of the women she knew used only a little makeup, but she wore absolutely none. She did, however, get her eyelashes dyed. The results were subtle yet noticeable. Following her appointments, people would often remark that Laura looked especially pretty, and Laura would shake her head when they asked if she'd done something. Had she gotten a facial or a haircut? Was she wearing makeup? 8 hours of sleep, maybe, she'd say with a shrug. It didn't feel like a deception. The dye only accentuated Laura's naturally long, thick lashes, which had once caught the attention of a transvestite on the Lexington Avenue subway who had wanted to know where she'd bought them. The dyeing process required Laura to lie down and close her eyes for 25 minutes. If she opened her eyes, the dye could get in and blind her. Because of the danger, New York State had recently outlawed the procedure, but Safrina, the Russian woman who'd been doing Laura's eyelashes for over a decade, continued to see clients in the back room of her mother's psychic parlor on 6th Avenue. After Safrina applied the dye, she set the egg timer, turned off the light, and left the room. Normally, soft classical music played in the background, but not today.
As Laura lay there alone in the quiet, she had a disturbing thought. What if the building were to catch on fire? Would she be able to feel her way out to the street with her eyes closed? Doubtful. Could she squint enough to see a little bit without the dye getting in? Her choices were blindness or third-degree burns, the consequences of an illegal beauty procedure. It seemed like a modern-day fable. The 25 minutes passed, and there was no fire. Sufrina returned, removed the excess dye, and all was well. Laura was on her way out the door when Sufrina's mother intercepted her.
"I see something you should know," she said,
tugging Laura behind a pair of velvet curtains into a purple room that smelled of incense. She pointed to a chair and instructed her to sit. Laura, who had to be back at work for a meeting, reluctantly obeyed.
"You are with child,"
the woman said, taking Laura's palm in her own. Laura wasn't sure if she was supposed to act surprised by this information, which had clearly been relayed to her by Sufrina, whose eyes, Laura had noticed, had unabashedly appraised her little belly when she'd lain down on the table in the back room. 11 weeks, Laura responded.
"It's a boy," the woman said. "You are having a son."
Laura smiled, as her instinct had told her the same thing.
"A boy needs a father."
Sufrina's mother shook her head grimly.
"Father is no good."
Laura wasn't sure how to respond. When the woman's scrutinizing gaze shifted from her palm to her face, her discomfort became irritation. She had not signed up for this. The incense made her nauseated. She needed to get back to work.
"You are afraid," the woman said. "Don't be afraid."
Laura nodded, hoping to move things along.
"There will be another man," she pronounced solemnly. "He will be father."
Of the city's many visual blights, the FDR, the Midtown Tunnel, Penn Station, the interior of Grand Central, to say nothing of the filth, soot, grit, grime, and dog shit that one encountered on a daily basis, it was the glass and steel high-rises that most upset Laura. Buildings of this sterile aesthetic had begun springing up in the 60s, but unlike the Chrysler and Empire State buildings, they were utterly devoid of charm and character. That was the point, to forego stylistic features traditionally associated with New York City architecture to achieve a generic, universal look. International style, it was called. If that was the look of the future, Laura was glad she wouldn't be around for it. More than merely mar the skyline, the proliferation of these phallic protrusions obstructed the light, casting the city in an ever-expanding shadow of corporate greed and consumerism. Even if people were to come to their senses and resume constructing buildings that were attractive to look at, the damage would be done, Laura thought sadly every time her sights snagged on the World Trade Center, which had now been there for a decade but which she would never get used to. Bibbs agreed. "A pair of glistening pricks in the sun," was her description. Nicholas had a more favorable opinion of the towers, and was very excited when his investment firm had relocated to the 47th floor of one the previous spring. Proud of his view, Nicholas invited Laura to pay a visit to his office, for the first time, to catch the sunset. "You must be curious to see where I spend my days." Laura was touched that Nicholas cared to impress her. She felt bad for him when she arrived and it was drizzling and overcast. He was waiting for her as she stepped off the elevator.
"Perfect timing," he said, glancing at his watch. 4:18. Sunsets in 26 minutes.
"Do you think we'll be able to see it?" Laura asked, following him down the hall. He walked briskly several paces ahead of her.
"It'll clear up," Nicholas said, opening the door to his office. "Have a seat."
He pointed to a leather armchair parked by the window. It had stopped raining, but there was still no trace of the sun. Laura sat, and Nicholas wheeled his desk chair over so that it was adjacent to hers. They quietly waited.
"I'm sorry, would you like something to drink?" Nicholas asked. "Coffee?"
A cup of herbal tea would be nice, Laura answered. Nicholas walked out to the hall. He returned empty-handed.
It's coming, he said.